If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, and welcome to Life of the Week, where leading historians delve into the lives of some of history's most intriguing and significant figures. From ancient Egyptian pharaohs and medieval warriors to daring 20th century spies. In the list of the world's all-time wealthiest people, one name regularly tops the charts: Mansa Musa. Ruling a kingdom that stretched across West Africa, the 14th century Mali emperor is best known for undertaking a glittering pilgrimage towards the holy city of Mecca. Yet, as Hannah Cusworth argues in this episode, Mansa Musa left a much larger legacy than that. Emily Briffitt spoke to Hannah to find out more about his extraordinary life.
So we are going to be diving into the life of Mansa Musa. And the big question we need to really answer is, who was Mansa Musa?
Yeah, it's a great starting question. So some of your listeners will have heard of Mansa Musa, but to other people, he'll be a new name. So to give you context, he's often described as the richest man that ever lived. He was an emperor in Mali, so we're in West Africa, and he ruled about the same time as Edward III in England. We're thinking a little bit sort of just pre the Black Death, and about 100 years after Genghis Khan, to give a little bit of context about sort of where and when and who.
So I think we need to dive right into that thing. He's known as the richest man in history. Is he?
So it's a really tough question to answer. And I think that's why I find Mansa Musa so fascinating, because we actually know quite a lot about him. There are quite a number of sources, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, but it's really hard to actually pin down incredibly specific details. So I guess it's always difficult when you're trying to convert money right from the medieval times to now, but we do think he probably, knowing how much gold, and that was where a lot of the source of his wealth has come from, knowing how much gold he had, we can pretty conclusively say that he's the richest man that ever lived. Although I think there's one BBC article that describes his wealth as kind of being indescribable, which I guess gives you a sense. We're talking like hundreds of billions here.
If we were to make comparisons, what would be Mansa Musa's equivalent net worth today?
I think the equivalent net worth, I've seen figures of about 400 billion. So we're talking like bigger than Jeff Bezos, bigger than Bill Gates, a really, really wealthy guy.
And why was the Mali Empire so wealthy?
The majority of this wealth came from gold. And that gold we see actually still today in Europe. If you see kind of medieval manuscripts or images of medieval rulers and they've got that kind of really like yellowy gold on their manuscripts, that will be, or like for their crowns, that will, we think, is gold from Mali that came through the Mali Empire. And because it was such a sought after commodity, Mali became very rich. And kind of Mansa Musa's control of those gold fields led to, yeah, an extraordinary level of wealth. But there was also salt, which was very important. You might think it's like an, obviously a really cheap thing today, but really important for preserving food. And so the control that Mali had over kind of salt in that area of the world also produced a lot of wealth.
This wealth is something that really benefited the Mali Empire.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We see that in some of the kind of building projects and that Mansa Musa was involved in, which I think we'll talk a bit about later.
Oh, definitely. I think this is a really important part of his story and legacy. But I think there's one particular story that we need to pick on first before we really dive into a bit more about Mansa Musa. And this is his pilgrimage to Mecca. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about this and why it's such a interesting and fascinating story.
Yeah, I think the pilgrimage, so he is Muslim, and the idea behind the pilgrimage is that once in every Muslim's lifetime, they should make this pilgrimage, the Hajj, and go to Mecca. And Mansa Musa, there's actually debates about what his kind of motivations were. Was it to show himself as a good Muslim? There is one source that talks about how he might have accidentally killed a female member of his family, and it's kind of a penance, but sources are unclear. And there's also an opportunity perhaps for Mali and for Mansa Musa to show the power of the empire by traveling across the desert up to North Africa. He stops off in Cairo and then makes the journey over to Mecca. So he does this a few years, about a decade-ish after we think he comes to power. Historians have said that part of that reason is it just takes a huge amount of time to prepare. You know, he's traveling with thousands of people, and he's also traveling with tons of gold. And so if you just think about like the logistics behind that and to get across the desert, we think it would have taken him years and years. There's also a number of enslaved people that come with him. So that is a part of the Mali Empire and of much of West Africa at this time. Those enslaved people would have had to have been likely gotten in raids. And so that would have taken time to build up this kind of retinue and then to travel across the desert to Cairo and to the Holy Land.
Now, this is an event that is known for its grandeur and the sheer number of people involved. Could you give us a picture of what it might have looked like if we were there at the time?
Yeah, I think it's almost kind of hard for us to imagine how grand it would have been. Some sources suggest it would have been about 60,000 people who would have been traveling with Mansa Musa. You've got a huge number of camels carrying all of the different provisions. You've got a huge retinue of enslaved people and people from the kind of equivalent of the court there. You've also got, I think there's one source that talks about that each of these 500 enslaved people had like a rod of gold. So we're talking about real kind of, it would have been dazzling, I think, is probably how I would describe it. All of that gold glittering in the sunshine across the desert and then into Egypt. We think that a lot more people left Mali with Mansa Musa than arrived in Cairo. And I think that's probably not surprising. It's important, actually, we don't see the desert at this time as just a kind of wasteland. Obviously, it's a very harsh environment, but it was full of trading routes. And there were really experienced guides who knew how to travel across the desert, where to stop for water. There were sort of trading posts. But it would have been an incredible journey. And many people kind of didn't quite make it all the way to Cairo and then to Mecca.
How did this number of people and this wealth that came with them affect the regions that Mansa Musa and his contingents passed through?
Yeah, that is a really good question. So Mansa Musa brought apparently so much gold with him that he actually depressed the price of gold in Cairo in Egypt for a number of years. I think there's one source that describes him as kind of flooding Egypt with gold. And yeah, depressed the price. But I think aside from that, it put Mali literally kind of on the map. And people probably would have known about Mansa Musa. He wouldn't have just turned up and been a complete surprise, like, oh, who is this guy? But it really made a name for Mansa Musa. It really made a name for the kingdom of Mali and for the amount of kind of gold that was there and the wealth of this kingdom. He also kind of impressed upon people that he was Muslim. And I think that was important to him and to his identity. And he's also often described as kind of being noble and generous. This word generous comes up quite a lot. So he made a really big impression as he was going on the pilgrimage.
And I think part of this might be due to the fact he was quite generous, I think, in his gift giving. Is that right?
Yes. He was incredibly generous in giving, so much so that it crashed the price of gold. There are also sources that talk about how, particularly on the way back from pilgrimage, so once he'd gone to Mecca, made his way back. And there are sources that talk about how by this point, the kind of the Malians were a little bit kind of down on their luck in terms of their resources. They'd sort of run out of money, perhaps because they had been so generous and had given away so much that they then ended up having to sort of buy back stuff for a much higher price than they had given it away for, and ended up having to sell some of the gifts, for example, a palace that Mansa Musa had been given. So yeah, the generosity made a really big impression and I think was really important for Mali's reputation, but it hurt his pockets.
Now, you mentioned, as you were talking, about it putting Mansa Musa's name on the map and the Mali Empire on the map. And I think that we need to talk a little bit about how not only regions in Africa saw Mansa Musa, but externally as well, because it did actually, he is on a map. He is on the Catalan map, I think, isn't he?
Yes, on a document, a map known as the Catalan Atlas. And it is a beautiful and really quite huge. I don't know if document kind of justify is a word to kind of justify how brilliant it is. We think it was made by a Majorcan, so we're sort of in Spain now, map maker, Jewish map maker called Kresk Abraham. And at this time, Jewish map makers were kind of really renowned for their skill and their knowledge of the world. And it includes West Africa and Mansa Musa. And some of your listeners probably would have seen this. And it hits him, Mansa Musa, on a throne holding like a massive piece of gold. Yeah. A really beautiful kind of evocative image. And it talks about him as being kind of Mansa Musa, king of kind of, I think it's like Guinea is sort of what he's described as. And it talks about his kind of wealth and his and how kind of noble he was. But this atlas doesn't just look at West Africa. It takes in kind of all of Europe, the Mediterranean, goes as far as China, parts of India. So it really gives you a sense of that Mali was part of this kind of the known world. And that I think often we have this idea of Africa at this time as being completely cut off from the rest of Europe, completely cut off from civilization. But that just really wasn't the case. It was well known about.
So it really gives us an insight into how connected Africa was to the rest of the medieval world. It's very much part of the story too.
Very much part of the story. And I think we have to remember that at this time, the Islamic world reaches quite far into Europe. So if we're thinking now about southern Spain, Andalusia, that's part of this kind of interconnected Islamic world that goes from southern Spain to West Africa, all across North Africa, to the Middle East. And I think that there was a huge amount of movement and of people and knowledge and culture and a kind of real connectivity that I think sometimes when we're studying British history, we kind of forget that, or we kind of just look at the world of kind of Britain and Western Europe, maybe sort of down to Italy. But there is this whole other kind of interconnected region that is important to remember.
So I think we should go right back to the beginning. Can you tell us, how did Mansa Musa actually become emperor?
So we have what we think is kind of Mansa Musa's words noted down by a kind of prominent historian. And he talks about how he became emperor, and it is a really intriguing story. So Mansa Musa talks about how the emperor before him was really interested in exploring the Atlantic Ocean, which I think is fascinating because we don't really see West Africa as being a kind of ocean-faring people. But Mansa Musa says it quite clearly that they were really interested in kind of finding the limits, and people have actually kind of speculated that maybe they reached South America. So we're not 100% sure, but what we do know was that Mansa Musa talks about the emperor before him was really interested in this exploration. He gets together a number of ships, I think about 200 ships, and he sends them off into the ocean to try and find what's out there. And one lone person kind of comes back. And he's like, right, not good enough. Let's go again. I'm in fact going to go. And he prepares 2,000 ships, one with kind of men, one with gold, which gives this idea that they think there's going to be people to trade with and that there's going to be kind of opportunities maybe for making a bit of money or for trading for different goods. So we've got these 2,000 ships, but they are never seen again. So the emperor, the old emperor, is gone. In this point, Mansa Musa is kind of acting as a deputy. So he's been kind of given that role. But then he has this, I think, brilliant phrase. It says, and then I became emperor in my own right, which I think shows us that kind of there are these rules of succession in Mali, but there's something to me a little bit like almost like sinister or underhand. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that was the case, but it is really, it's a really fascinating story, which I think kind of opens as many questions as it answers.
That seems so intriguing. Now, when he actually became emperor, do we know what he was like as ruler?
We know that he, or the sense we get from the source materials, that he's actually relatively young when he becomes emperor. And one historian, Michael Gomez, has talked about, you know, is there actually an issue here around the succession? Is there, you know, more to the story than Mansa Musa is letting on? Was there at some point kind of a region, you know, how young was he? And why was this incredible empire left in the hands of really quite a young man? We know that in that kind of early part of his reign, or we can kind of surmise working backwards from the Hajj, from the pilgrimage, that he would have spent a lot of time preparing for it, just because of the sheer kind of number of people and gold that he would have taken with him. This isn't something that you just like, he decides to go on pilgrimage one day and the next day he's off. So that's probably what took up an early part of his reign. There's not many accounts, although we're thinking about an empire here, and it's an empire that's expanding, which makes you think there probably is war, violence, conquest. There aren't that many accounts of kind of Mansa Musa being a really tyrannical ruler. And actually the word Mansa gives this idea of more of a kind of mythical or hereditary ruler, rather than another word in the, I think it's the Mandinga language, which is more like farmer. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which kind of suggests more of a like military, martial, tyrannical ruler. And that word isn't really applied to Mansa Musa. So I think we get this sense that he's, I don't know, kind of hereditary, justified, maybe even like enlightened emperor.
I think that's a really interesting point to actually touch on the etymology of Mansa Musa himself and his actual name. As a side note, what sources do we actually have about Mansa Musa?
As historians, we always want more sources, right? I think we'll never be satisfied with the number of sources that we have. But this period in Mali's history is actually really well documented with external sources, or contemporary external sources, primarily from historians who were from the Islamic world writing in Arabic. One historian, Al-Umari, who passes through Cairo not that long after Mansa Musa has. One historian who actually visits Mali, he makes that journey down into Western Africa, or at least that's what we think from what he wrote, after Mansa Musa has died. So the reign is pretty well documented. Externally, though, we then have later sources that are from West Africa, but they're written a few hundred years after Mansa Musa's rule. So, you know, I guess sometimes we have to take those things with a grain of salt, or at least historians have to think carefully about how they're using those sources. Another really important thing when we're thinking about the Mali Empire is oral history, which is passed down by storytellers, sometimes called griots. And they record this history and pass it on. It's kind of more than facts. It's kind of almost poetry in a way. Interestingly, the oral history is actually is more silent on Mansa Musa than it is on some of his ancestors. And I think that is really fascinating to think about. You know, why is that? Why do external sources really talk about Mansa Musa? Is it because we're really interested in his money and his gold, but inside Mali, it's not seen as such a big deal? Whereas the sort of epic of his ancestor Sundiata is much more interesting. So I don't know, but it's something I've been thinking about.
So I just wanted to return. You spoke a little bit earlier about him not being seen as this tyrannical ruler, but also about this idea of expansion and how the Mali Empire grew. Could you give us a sense of what the Mali Empire looked like at the start of his reign and how much it expanded? Where should we be thinking of in our minds?
The thing that I want to get across is just how much land the empire covered. And if we're thinking about it in terms of like present day countries, we're going from parts of Senegal to southern Mauritania, Mali, Burkina Faso, western Niger, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, northern Ghana. I mean, it was an incredibly large land empire. And it had its origins in the sort of upper reaches of the Niger River. But by the time of Mansa Musa and the people who came after him, the rulers that came after him, we're right across to the Atlantic Ocean. So it is a really sizable piece of land that Mali is kind of in control of. And we get this sense that there are some parts of it that are, I guess, core, and they're Islamicized. There are other parts of the empire, particularly where the gold comes from, where sources suggest that the Malians and Mansa Musa didn't try and press their religion or kind of hold that area too tightly, because it was said that if they did, then the gold production just sort of dropped off. I guess people in protest were like, no, if you come too close, if you push too hard, we're gonna stop the production of gold. And so they had what it seems like a different approach, perhaps, to different areas of the empire. But we're thinking also about places like Timbuktu, which I think I heard of as a child, even though not quite knowing exactly kind of what it meant. But Mansa Musa turned it into a really great center of learning. And though that was part of the empire that kind of came in much later, wasn't the kind of original center of the empire.
Of course, as you say, Mansa Musa wasn't just keen on this idea of expansion, but it was this development of learning, literacy. Could you tell us more about this?
Mansa Musa was seemingly really interested in education, and we get this sense of him coming back from pilgrimage from Mecca, and while he's doing so, meeting people who he's convincing to come back to Mali, architects, poets, I guess people we kind of describe as academics. And so Timbuktu is obviously already a place, but I think Mansa Musa really helps it to flourish. There is a building of mosques, the Sankore Mosque, which still exists, buildings which are still kind of part of the University of Timbuktu. And a real great emphasis on books and religious education, so madrasas, and architecture, and this kind of real kind of building program. And some historians have sort of talked about that as, you know, as an empire, you don't just want to rule just through might. You also want to develop a sort of a common culture and to show people that there are benefits of being part of the empire. And part of that might have been literacy. I think there's also this sense that through literacy and sort of really tight record keeping, it helps you to kind of control an empire in certain ways. But I think that is one of his biggest legacies, that sort of culture of learning and of beautiful, beautiful architecture, which thankfully still stands to this day.
Could you tell us about some of these places that he had so much influence in the architecture of?
Yeah, there's a couple of mosques which are still standing today, and I would really encourage your listeners to give them a quick look up on the internet, because they are almost kind of otherworldly in some senses. It's sort of mud construction and really kind of beautiful kind of curved shapes. Two in particular, there's the Sankore Mosque, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and then the Jingari Bir Mosque, which is still standing, thankfully, because there was an attack, some of your listeners might have heard, in Mali by extremists in around sort of 2012, and there was a little bit of damage, but they have been preserved, still standing, and are some really kind of fine examples of beautiful architecture.
So coming to the end of Mansa Musa's life, I think we need to talk about his death. How did he actually die?
For someone who was so well known about, you would think that we would have a really clear idea of how he died. Sources differ, and we don't actually have a particularly clear picture. And I think that is, I mean, what does that tell us? Is it that by the end of his reign, he wasn't seen as so significant, or that what was people were really interested in was his wealth, and therefore the kind of the end of his life isn't something which has been so sort of carefully recorded? What that's one of the things I find fascinating about Mansa Musa, is that he kind of blazed and shone so brightly and clearly was a really important figure in West African, but also in kind of global history. But there are parts of his birth, for example, and his death that we just don't know a huge amount about, or we kind of have conflicting sources about. You know, some people, I think there's even a source saying he kind of died as part of the pilgrimage. And then there are other sources which are like, no, that's definitely not right. You know, he came back to Mali, he established Timbuktu and these kind of building construction projects. So yeah, a bit of a man of mystery in terms of how he came to power and in terms of how he died.
Now, this is the important thread that we've been discussing throughout about Mansa Musa's legacy. Could you tell us what has been his legacy, and have attitudes changed recently to how we've been looking at him?
Yeah, I'll talk a bit about his legacy first. And I used to be a secondary school teacher and actually taught about Mansa Musa. And that was one of the questions that we spoke to the children about what really was his legacy. There's clearly this sort of cultural educational legacy with Timbuktu, the universities, the madrasas, the literacy and creation of manuscripts, which were in jeopardy, so there are thousands and thousands of Timbuktu manuscripts which still survive. There's this massive digitization program led by Malian academics. When they were under attack, a huge number of people actually took these manuscripts into their homes to kind of preserve that legacy. And now, not all of them were written during the time of Mansa Musa, but I think you can argue that that was, you know, that was part of his legacy. I think there's also this idea of West Africa and Mali being put on the map, both figuratively and literally. But I feel like until quite recently, that legacy's sort of been lost. And he was so well known about in his time and then, you know, just after his death. And then I feel like he hasn't been remembered until quite recently, where I feel like there has been a real move to put him into school curriculums and to have podcasts like this one. Now, why is that? And I think that's always really interesting to think about. Why do certain figures in history go kind of almost in and out of fashion? And why do we remember some people and forget others? Is it because we've had this rise of kind of tech billionaires? And so we're really interested in thinking about, you know, who was the richest man of all time? Is it because I think there is a move to think more about Black history and to teach it in schools, and for Black history in English schools, not just to be about the transatlantic slave trade and Windrush, but to think a bit more about these African kingdoms. I also wonder if it's partly because of when we're thinking about Islam and what Islam looks like, and to kind of knowing that Islam has many different histories, and that there was this kind of Islamic world that reached right down into Western Africa. What I do know is that when I used to teach my children about Mansa Musa, they were fascinated. Partly, I think, because they were like, miss, how much, you know, how rich was he? But I also think, you know, in the classrooms that I taught in, a lot of students had one idea of kind of what Black people in the past were like. And that is very different to Mansa Musa, with his kind of wealth, his learning, his education, his mobility.
With all that in mind, do you think it's fair to simply reduce the story of Mansa Musa down to him simply being the richest man in history?
I think it's a really good hook. It's a really good hook to get people interested in a period of history that I don't think we are particularly familiar with in Britain, this sort of medieval West African history, if you kind of want to call it that. But I think it tells us so much more about the region, about how connected it was, particularly to the rest of the Islamic world, but actually even to kind of Western Europe, when we're thinking about that, the trade in gold. And I think it really makes us rethink, actually, what West Africa was like prior to the transatlantic slave trade, and a little bit differently, I suppose, about Islam. And I think for all of those reasons, yeah, it's definitely, you know, a nice thing to throw around about him being the richest man, but I think it tells us a lot more actually about history.
That was Hannah Cudsworth, PhD researcher with English Heritage and History Education Consultants. Thanks for listening to today's Life of the Week. Be sure to join us again next time to learn about another fascinating figure from the past.